G'day, I'm Rowan Mackey, and I'm joined by my dad, clinical psychologist Chris Mackey, and this is Psych Spiels and Silver Linings. All right, well, Dad, today we have the pleasure and the privilege of being joined by Dr. Ken Harris, who is a chiropractor, educator, lecturer, author, and keynote speaker. He was the founder of the Waldwick Wellness Center in New Jersey. Ken first established his practice in 1974 and in 1993 established the Mind Body Wellness Education Center, which is dedicated to the exploration, understanding, and promotion of the mind-body-spirit connection. Ken is a former professor of the New York Chiropractic College and holds a bachelor's in psychology and a master's in education and has written two books, Synchronicity, The Magic, The Mystery, and The Meaning, released in 2019, and was the lead author and organizer of the book Second Chances, From Surviving to Thriving, that you yourself wrote a chapter for as well, Dad. So sure, that'll come up at some stage today. But Ken, thank you so much for coming on the show with us.
Yes, thank you, Ken.
I feel honored and privileged to speak to you from down, from up over to down under.
Terrific. And it's a wonderful opportunity to tell people a little bit more about this book, Second Chances, a wonderful book. We'll talk about what it's about shortly. But the subtitle, From Surviving to Thriving, gives a bit of a clue about that. But I might just mention to people how we met, Ken. We met through our mutual interest in synchronicity. And so you've written the book on that, that Rowan described, and I've written a book on synchronicity, and we've met with a number of other authors and people who have expertise in that field, the field of understanding the nature of meaningful coincidences and how they can impact on our lives. And so we met through the Coincidence Project, where we'd often have monthly Zoom meetings and catch up that way. So it was always a delight to meet you, Ken, and you remind me of a Get Smart character. Simon the Likeable has got a bit of a twinkle in his eye. That's how I think of you, Ken, but I'm sure it'll come up later on about our mutual interest in synchronicity.
I would say, Chris, it was no coincidence that we met. It was a divine appointment.
I'd agree with that, Ken.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit more about that in a little bit of time, Ken. But I suppose just to start, we may as well start with the book, Second Chances. You've both contributed to this book. And I suppose the theme of it, this idea of surviving to thriving, is a little bit of an underlying theme on our podcast in some ways. So I suppose just maybe a slight sort of broad question at first. Well, when was the book released and what does it include in terms of the stories that are in there?
It was released on October, I think it was 27th at Life University. We had a big splash. We had an opening. 15 of the authors showed up in person, told their stories. But the book came into beingness through my near-death experience that I had. I was told to go back into my body. I'm not finished. Finish your mission. And I had this intuitive understanding that I was supposed to collect other people who had a second chance at life. And of course, your father has had a second chance at life, as has everyone in this book. And most of them found me through synchronicity. I didn't have to go too far looking for them. I mean, I was giddy almost to think that, oh, I just put my story out there and people started calling me and asking me, can I be in the book? Even the editor, when she did the story, she says, hey, and this is unusual for an editor, can I be in the book too? I've had a second chance. And so her story is in the book as well. But the gamut runs from near death to catastrophic illness, recovery, to loss of loved ones, to loss of property, loss of mentality, as your dad went through his metamorphosis with his own challenge with depression, and blah, blah, blah. So the book is a supermarket for the world. There is a story in that book for everyone. They'll relate to one or two of those stories, and it will give them hope and inspiration. Number one, not to give up, surrender to life, trust life, and allow life to work out. And you can come through the storms of life with post-traumatic growth, not more stress.
Well, you've said a lot about what motivated you to write the book, Ken, looking to impart that hope as well to other people. Just out of interest, when and how did the idea come to mind to write that book? Did it come in a bit of a flash or did it evolve the idea? How did it come to you?
Well, I call them innate flashes. That's when the soul speaks to the persona. So after my heart attack, when I recovered, I asked the question, why am I back? What's my next step? What's my next iteration? Because I had been involved with synchronicity, as you know, Chris, and I even bought the domain called Dr. Synchronicity, because I believe I'm one of the most high frequency coinciders on the planet. I have them every day. I mean, I get giddy almost. Anyway, I got the hit. I said, you know, I was given a second chance. I bet you there were other people who had second chances. And people would like to read those stories to get some hope and inspiration. So it was an innate flash.
Trivian, we'll ask you a little bit more detail about your own story of having a heart attack. It's a remarkable story, and it has some remarkable synchronicity associated with it. But first, a couple of other things in relation to the book.
Well, I suppose you mentioned it slightly there in terms of the contributors to the book and how they maybe found you as much as you found them. But I suppose, yeah, do you maybe have any stories about how maybe some people came to be in the book? Because I understand that there's some quite incredible even chance encounters that allowed people to connect with you and end up in the book.
Yeah, I'm smiling. I don't believe in chance. Personally, I think everything is divinely appointed at the right time, at the right place. You have to stay aware, awake, and alert to connect the dots. All right, so my friend Bobby Dineen, let me tell you how I met him. I love this man. I'm up in a little island called Captiva Island, which is north of Naples, Florida. And I'm eating lunch at a place called the Key Lime Bistro. Now, Bobby Dineen, his wife Susan, and his several other friends were sitting within two feet of me. And he had a T-shirt on with a nice saying on it. And I tapped him and I said, hey, sir, what does that mean? He had some kind of a monogram. And he turns around and he looks at me with the most beautiful smile. He's just got a radiant smile. And I said to him, sir, I didn't even know his name. Do you know you have a $1 million smile? And you know what he said to me? That's what it cost me to get. I says, what happened? Well, here's his backstory. He was a lineman. He was the guy who goes out in the middle of storms, fixes the power lines. But he did his friend a favor who wanted to take down his tree, a 24-foot tree. Unfortunately, he was on the top of the tree when the tree snapped, and he fell 24 feet right onto his face. Broke all his bones in his face, his jaw, all his teeth, lacerated his aorta, ruptured his spleen, ruptured his liver. They gave him last rites three times. They called him the miracle man in the hospital. He couldn't eat for 6 or 7 months. His jaw was wired shut. And during that time period, he wanted to go, but he had this burning desire to want to live, survive, and tell the story. If you saw him today, you would never know he was ever injured. He's one of the most giving, loving people I've ever met. But me, by that blip, that flippant statement, hey, you got a $1 million smile, that's how I met him.
Of all the compliments you could give someone who'd had that kind of experience, that'd have to be about the best one, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, no. Then he asked me one question. He says, you know, I follow this guy, Dr. Wayne Dyer. He's telling me, have you ever heard of him? He's asking me. I says, have I ever heard of him? I was his doctor. I took care of him.
That's amazing.
And that's when we bonded right then and there. We knew we were soul brothers. And he's one of my closest friends now in the last 2 years. He's in the AA program. He helps thousands of people. He's a sponsor. And he had no motivation to be in the book other than want to help people. He was one of the few authors who didn't have a program to sell, that he wasn't a healer. He didn't have a coaching. He didn't have an online anything. He paid his money to be in a book, to tell a story, to inspire other people. That's the kind of guy. He's from Wisconsin, family of nine. So he's this one. I met another lady. Her name is Kia Scher. Now, Kia Scher, she heard me interviewed on another podcast. So she calls me up. She says, my name's Kia. I'm the director of this center in Virginia, and I would love to interview you about your book on synchronicity. I says, great. I said, where do you live in Virginia? She says, here's where it gets interesting. She says, well, I live at the Synchronicity Retreat Foundation. I said, you're kidding me. Let me see some. I didn't believe her. So she puts the camera behind her and it says Synchronicity Retreat Center. Here's the backstory. They had been in business for over 50 years. They do sound meditation healing, synchronization between right and left hemispheres. And all their meditation is based on music and sound and frequency. I said, how did you become the director? And she paused and she said, well, my husband used to be the director of the center. She said, but unfortunately, Ken, in 2008, my husband my 13-year-old daughter, and several members of our community were hired by the Indian government to come and teach them this type of sound healing. It was in the city of Mumbai. You know what happened in the city of Mumbai in 2008? The terrorists from Pakistan came in and killed all of them. And I said, oh my God. I mean, I said, and how did you handle that? She said, how did I handle it? She said, I made a decision. Sometime later, I got on an airplane. I flew to India and I had offered healing seminars for the people who killed my family. And I just sat back and I said, Kia, that's Christ-like. I'm from the South Bronx. I probably wouldn't have gotten a machine gun and want to go over there and kill him. I wasn't that evolved spiritually. But this is the type of people that I've attracted. She's an angel incarnate. She said, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in revenge and hatred. And so her chapter is called The Road to Resilience. And that's another example of someone in the book who I'm just enamored and humbled by. And your father's story, I don't want to tell his story, but his story too. I mean, you'll tell it later, Chris, but that was like, he went from the frying pan into the fire, back out to run the hospital. I'm laughing. I mean, you can talk about if you want, Chris, later on. That's a real comeback kid story.
Yes, well, here's shortly of your story too, and then I'll say a little bit of mine, yes.
Well, it seems from those like just incredible stories that you mentioned there, Ken, that there seems to be maybe an element of putting yourself out there and the universe providing in some way. And I suppose what I wonder is, has that been your experience since the book's been put up? It's been such a wonderful message to put out there and something that's so relevant to our time. So I wonder if you've had an experience of, for example, putting the book out there and maybe receiving, whether it even be some particular feedback or something that
we're getting letters from all over the world. If you go on Amazon, read the reviews, people are being touched by this book. It's changing lives. And I would dare to say in some cases may even save a life by them getting the hope that to keep going, not to give up. The universe will conspire to support you. Once you make a conscious decision, I'm not done. There's more to give. And everybody in that book has takeaways, positive takeaways. Everyone came out of the storms of their lives with growth. No one decided to go down and become a victim. We're all in very real sense victors. And we're here to just share our stories to give people hope and inspiration. So I'm getting letters now from all over the world as a result of this book being launched in October.
Wonderful.
Oh, I'm sure it'd be very uplifting experience. And there seems to be a large element of the book, obviously dealing with trauma and I'm sure post-traumatic stress, but that of course leading to post-traumatic growth. And I suppose, even in terms of, say, your motivations for the book or what you want people to get out of it, is there a sense of, you even mentioned it before, say, hopefulness that you feel that people would receive from the book and have been receiving?
Yes, absolutely. You see, all the stories are sad to what happened to us. However, they all have happy endings. And I tell people when they buy the book, I said, now listen, get the box of tissues next to you. Do not read this book from A to Z like a novel. Read one story a night or one story a week. Savor it. Let it sink in. Pick from the titles what speaks to you. But you're going to be emotionally evoked. You can't read this book and not tear up at times to realize what these people have come through. I mean, it's inspirational for me. I mean, listen, the author, when she started reading the story, the editor, when she started reading the stories, she said, hey, you know, I had a story. I said, well, tell me a story. Her name is Marissa. She said, I was 23 years old. I was on my way to become a nurse. I'm walking across the street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I get hit by a drunk driver at 50 miles an hour. I should have died. It took her 10 years to rebuild her life to the point where she became Miss New York. She kind of learned how to walk and speak and talk out of a wheelchair. What an inspiration. And her book, her chapter is called The Line of Demarcation. My life before the accident, my life after the accident. And during our launch, it came out you weren't there, Chris, because of 13,000 miles away. But anyway, during the launch, she told her story. Now, she was 23 when it happened. It just so happens, coincidentally, to be 23 stories. That's how it worked out. That's another thing. So she was age 23, 23 stories. And that year, this last year, October, she turned 46. She went back to the prison and forgave the man who ran her down.
Wow. Well, again, remarkable compassion, forgiveness, an enlightened approach, just like Kia Sher that you mentioned earlier on. And one of the things I think that's wonderful about the book is so many of the chapters are just something like half a dozen pages, yet it's really distilled, the message of the dark times that people went through. So you get a real sense of this dreadful plight that people were facing. You think, well, how's someone going to get out of this? But then there was some kind of transformation that occurred in some way. It's remarkable, we'll come back to it later on, but how often there was some level of synchronicity involved in that as well. But the main theme being, dark times can seem like they might be endless, or we might be in a situation we think there's no way of getting out of this, and then something happens. So it'll be interesting, Ken, to hear a little bit about your own story about having had a heart attack and how that resolved.
So I'm in California with my wife, Judith, who I'm now married 55 years. She saved my life, actually. But we were walking on the beach, and I didn't feel quite good. I said, Judy, slow down. I'm usually ahead of her, but I got very fatigued very fast. I said, and then I got shaky. I said, we better go back to the condo, which is about 20, 25 minutes away. And maybe you should make me something to eat. My blood sugar, I think, has dropped. I had a challenge with diabetes and hypoglycemia. So we get back to the condo. Good thing. She makes me a lunch sandwich. I take one bite. Now, if there are any ladies listening to this podcast, I want you to know, I know what a hot flash feels like. I had that experience. Every pore of my body opened up. And then I got so nauseous to the point where I could have projectile vomited across the room. And then the most god-awful pain I've ever experienced, simultaneously, it felt like someone was stabbing me in the center of my chest and the middle of my back, and I couldn't breathe. And I looked at my wife and I said, 911. And I collapsed. Well, as fate would have it, the first responders, the firemen and the MIC unit, the mobile intensive care unit, they were down the block. They were within 2 minutes of me that day. Amazing. On another call. And so they got to me right away and they started treating me on the spot. And then they made a decision to take me to a trauma center that was unfortunately 20 miles north almost of us, because the local hospital was on diversion. They couldn't take me. So these guys, you know, they rolled me out. I looked at my wife and I thought that would be the last time I'd ever see her. And guess what I said? As you know, in the World Trade Center, what do people tell you when they think they're going to die? I want you to know I loved you my entire life. They get me in the bus, the ambulance, we go north. There's a car accident. Now, my wife is in the front of the bus with the first responders. They call ahead. They cross the highway, Route 5, and they go north on the south side because they don't want me to die in the back of the bus. These men put their own lives at risk. They didn't have to do it. They get me into the ER. I'm in and out of consciousness with this. A nurse grabs my head right off the gurney, right out of the bus. I open my eyes, and she leans in. And I thought she was going to give me an adjustment. I'm a chiropractor. She grabs my head, cradles it, and whispers in my ear, we got your back, and we're going to take care of you. What a reassurance that was. Wow. To hear those words. The next thing I know, six people are picking me up, putting me on an examination table, cutting my clothes off, and sticking me with pins everywhere. And 15 people are running around the room to save my life. It's crazy. That's when I came out of my body. I was watching this. I said, wow, this is interesting. Look at this. Anyway, they get me to the STEMI lab. The little doctor comes in. I regain consciousness. She says to me, Dr. Kenny, I know you like Deepak Chopra. You're an Ayurvedic doctor. But if you don't let me do this right now, you're going to die right here. And I knew she meant it. I said, okay, go. So they put two stents in me. And they opened up. I had 100% blockage of my artery. They opened up the proximal and distal end of the artery. The blood started to flow. It took about a half hour and all the pain stopped. And so everything that she happened, and here's the coincidence. That doctor was the number one interventional cardiologist in all of Southern California for her skill set. She had just come from New York, from St. Luke's Roosevelt Medical Center, where this new hospital in Oceanside built a STEMI lab just for her. They created this just for her, and I was one of the first people to be treated. So I'm laughing. She told me if I had gone to the hospital closer by, I would have expired. They didn't have a STEMI lab and they didn't have the skill set to actually do what she did. It's an art. The STEMI lab they have to snake it up through your groin. The needle's about that big. They stick it up and it goes right into your heart arteries and they go boop, boop, and they open it. So everything was 100% synchronistic.
Wow, that's a life-saving example of the universe provides.
Well, I think it was grace. By grace alone, I would survive.
Well, I think it's just an incredible story that you talk about there, Ken. And I suppose what I wonder from that is, like you mentioned before, having that almost out-of-body experience and going back.
Not in, almost. No,
yeah,
no,
yeah, well, yeah.
Had it.
Having that out-of-body experience. And was that something that I suppose even before having a heart attack that you had a real sense of maybe – or, you know, just the fortuitous, uncanny timing of things contributing towards things like this, such as your survival? Or was that almost experience the real catalyst for what is now just, you know, your infectious energy towards, I suppose, life and everything that comes with it?
Well, I was a pretty happy camper before, but I used to complain a little bit. And I'll be honest. I've been in the mind-body business my entire life, you know, between spiritual interaction, physical interaction, emotional interaction, and mental. But there was always a little 1%. Maybe this is all BS. You just die and you're dead and they never go on. You know, I made it all up. 1%. 99% I believed in faith. Now I know 100% there is no death. There's physical death, but there's no death of the soul. You know, that was my takeaway. That was the gift of me having a heart attack. I am totally unafraid of dropping my body. When the time comes, as long as I play all my music, I'm happy to go. Because I was at total peace, by the way. I didn't beg. I wasn't begging and hoping. I'm hoping. No, I was surrendered, totally surrendered. If I lived, it was great. And if I didn't, it was okay.
That's such a contrast from a famous Australian who died a number of years ago, but earlier on, Kerry Packer, the richest man in Australia, had a heart attack and he was in hospital and I think he was technically dead for a brief period of time. He had a very different worldview. He recovered, he survived, and he basically said, as though it was a fact to tell everybody else, he said, "There's nothing there." He said, "I died and there's nothing there." And
that was his experience.
That was his experience. And I think what was maybe unfortunate is that being his experience, but it seemed that he wanted to declare that as a fact to the rest of the world. Actually, he was a media baron, so he looked to get a lot of news out to other people. Unfortunately, I think that's a more restricted, limited form of news than the news that you brought following your experience. And again, as you say, it comes back to people's experience. But I know what sounds a hell of a lot more uplifting and you're relating your honest experience of what you encountered, what you felt.
Yes. So the bottom line, Chris, is if you were to ask me, Ken, what does chocolate taste like? You know what I would say, Chris? Here, have a piece. You can't describe it. Everybody's experience is unique and different. If you go on the NDA websites and listen to every story is different. And there's some commonalities. A lot of them talk about the light and the council and Jesus here and Buddha there. But my experience was different. My experience was I felt when I heard the voice that I actually heard the voice of my own soul self, the soul that Ken is, not this physical personality Ken, but the essence of who I am and who I've always been. Because my belief, my experience now is who I am wasn't born and who I am will never die. It's eternal. It's part of the divine. It's part of the Godhead, whatever that is to you. So my experience was, if the people say, did you meet God? I said, well, I think I met the God within me. And that same God is within everybody. That spark, that divine something is in all living matter.
I suppose a question about that, Ken, like, was that an immediate realization for you? Like the way that you described that there, it almost seems like such a almost profound set of circumstances that it would almost take your mind a little time to get your head around it. Like, was that almost for lack of a better term, a linear experience where you went through this experience and thought, hold on, you know, the world's opened up to me in a completely different way? Or was there maybe a sense of, or trying to get your head around things slightly and almost, yeah, taking a little bit of time to get to the position that you're in now and having this understanding?
It wasn't my head. I didn't find that through my head. I found it through my heart, through the emotional realm. It was an epiphany. I just laughed. I when I heard it, I said, I was looking like, who's talking? And I realized I was talking to myself. The real self. You know, here's my construct. I have an ego mind and I have a soul mind. My ego mind lives here. I still have ego. I'm in the body. You're always going to have a sense of individuation. So the ego's here and the soul lives here. And so who do you want to pay attention to? The ego self says, what's in it for me? And the soul self says, how can I help? I pay more attention to this guy. And I tell people, here's a metaphor I give you. Let your soul drive the vehicle. This is the vehicle, the car. Put your ego in the passenger seat. You need an ego to navigate through this world of time and space. But there is a place beyond time and space. It's not linear. It's not mental. It's another frequency. If you're on a station on your radio and there's a lot of static coming in, sometimes you just got to tweak that to a different frequency and you get a clear shot. So I think we're living on different frequencies all the time. And the soul usually will whisper initially to get your attention. But if you don't pay attention, it'll hit you with a 2x4. Pay attention to this voice. How can I help? My prime mission is to give and receive love. If I had to succinctly say, why am I here? It's the giving and the receiving of love. All the other stuff, Mickey Mouse, drama, not important.
I like that way of putting it, Ken. Soul mind and ego mind. Deep insights there. Deceptively simply put. I like the way that you put all of that. Now, you mentioned about experience. Now, something which is not so much an uplifting experience, but a number of our listeners would relate to. And I'll mention a little bit about my experience with depression. We might talk about depression, the nature of it, what it's like. But so the chapter that I contributed was A Lasting Return from Hell on Earth, about being hospitalized with depression. I was hospitalized twice after I'd been working for 10 years at a psychiatric hospital. I'd been a senior psychologist for 5 years. So I felt it was really shameful, a shameful failure to descend into a depression myself. There are many stresses at the time. There are a lot of hospital conflicts and tensions at that time, other things as well. But the upshot of it was being admitted to hospital in a time where I felt no hope whatsoever. And I appreciated you interviewing me about that on your podcast a couple of weeks ago. And sort of one of the things that was profound, though, that I found from that time, and I might check with you afterwards, Ken, because I think from brief exchanges before, you might have experienced something of depression yourself. But I'll say something that I gained from this experience. And I even had some awareness at the time. I felt like I was sinking, falling, this really heavy pull, just descending into darkness, like descending into hell in a certain way. But with the visitors, the well wishes of family, friends, my wife, Sue, I felt that there were strands gradually forming at my back, halting the fall. And afterwards, that was part of what helped me go through a very slow recovery, which I recognized I needed to deal with, the demon of perfectionism in me, which I'd let get out of hand. And perfectionism is it's probably the number one personality trait that contributes to depression. And what helped me in the end, with the assistance of a couple of therapists I saw, but a very masterful therapist helped me do this exercise where I confronted this dark, perfectionistic, almost demonic character, just beating myself up for being in this situation. But I came to realize that if I could come to handle this slow, pathetic recovery, you know, very public, my colleagues knew I was off work for 6 months, then I thought I could handle anything. So all I needed to do was to deal with this marked vulnerability and imperfection. I needed to let in the support of other people, which was profound. And one of the few things that gave me a little bit of hope that good might come out of it, but it came later because I wasn't so aware of time when I went into the hospital, but it turned out I was admitted to the hospital at 6 o'clock on the 6th of June. And I'd previously experienced that to be a very auspicious time, even before I got engaged to Sue, my wife, at 6 o'clock on the 6th of June. And that was an accident. You certainly don't plan to be admitted to hospital at that time. But like the bookends of my life, if like heaven and hell on earth, getting engaged, being admitted to a psychiatric hospital, it kind of that this resonance of the numbers kind of underscored the notion that there can be meaning in all of these things. It's not as if one experience is, yes, that's good to have and forget the rest. It's best if you just never had it. I learned an enormous amount about dealing with perfectionism, being able to have more realistic standards. I learned a hell of a lot about having to let other people in, not expecting myself to always be able to manage everything myself without that kind of support. Dare I say, little less separating myself from other people, think I should be so independent in how I manage with challenges. And I've certainly noticed that with many of my certainly many of my clients over the years, but other people I've known, family members and others, the importance of letting other people in for that kind of support. So some of the most wonderful lessons I've learned in my life, some of the most helpful lessons I've learned in my life, came out of that very dark period. And again, I really appreciated the opportunities other people have to put some of that experience in a chapter in the book, and hoping that that imparts hope to others. Because when you're very deeply depressed, you're barely getting a couple of hours sleep a night, you just sort of can't see any future because of the negativity that goes with depression. People can reach a point where they think that they'll never get out of it. And I felt I knew I would never recover. Despite 10 years of seeing clients get better from depression, when I was in that situation, I believed I knew I would never recover. And I just, I'd go through the motions and not say that to other people. But that was my deeper belief. And it took quite a bit to shift that. But a lot of good things came alongside the shifting of it. So, yeah, an example of there can be real, really meaningful gains that come out of the darkest times. I wonder, Ken, if you relate to any of that, or if you'd have any comments about an experience of depression.
I'll digress, but I want to just acknowledge you had to overcome your shame that you weren't perfect. Mm-hmm. I say to people, I am perfectly imperfect. I've accepted my light and shadow aspects now. I'm a whole person. I've embraced the shadow. So the shadow was deconstructing you. You were being crucified by your ego. Yeah. And there was a part of your ego says, I'll do it myself. I don't need anybody else to help me. Well, that was a big lesson for you to ask for help, so that a community of support came and stopped you from falling totally through the floor. And so that's ego. When you don't want to ask for help, that's the ego saying, you don't need anybody else. You can do it. It's not true. We can rarely ever do it by ourselves. We live in community. Now, in our book, there's another lady, Nicole Timperano, who actually committed suicide. And she was unconscious, and her husband found her. And she spoke, and there were tears in the audience when she said, I never believed I was worthy of asking for help. I was ashamed. Shame is the first in as a child, and it's the last thing out as an adult. We have to overcome our shame that we're not perfect beings. Someone nailed us. Mother, father, teacher, preacher, culture told us something, and we bought this belief system that we had to be perfect to get love. It's not true. It's not true. So in my own experience, I had what they call cyclical depression due to what they call seasonal affective disorder. I used to get kind of tired in November, and like a bear, I wouldn't come back out until April, because the sun in the Northern Hemisphere was not plentiful. Now you see where I live. I live in Florida. I need sun. There's a physiology. It's called seasonal affective disorder. You know what it is, Chris, through the retina, through the pineal, through the pituitary, melatonin's produced. It's a hormonal thing. And so there's a physical basis for depression in some cases. Now, I resisted taking drugs, because as a chiropractor, I always believed medicine was my food, but I needed to get light. And so I bought a light box, which helped to manage my depression in the winter. And I try to go away as much as I could, but light is a nutrition, photons. We're light beings, we're light energy. The pineal gland is a light gland. It actually activates all the other endocrine systems through the light in the pineal and the pituitary. So there's, it's not always psychological. It sometimes it's physiological. And so each person has to figure out, diet plays a big role in depression, lack of exercise, and childhood trauma. Most people who were traumatized in childhood will wind up depressed later in life. And unfortunately, in my family, we had a lot of trauma. We had police in my house, fist fights. I mean, I grew up in the hood. I was in gangs and drugs. So I didn't come with a silver spoon in my mouth. This is the polished version, folks. This is at age 77. I finally arrived. I'm happy with inside my own skin. But I went through it. And at age 50, I tried to commit suicide. I was so despondent, even though I know everything. I was in such a low point. And it was a confluence of factors. My father died. My wife was going to divorce me. My kids weren't talking to me. And it was winter. And so only by the grace of, if you believe in God, my friend saved my life. And so I'm still here at age 50. So it's 27 years since I've been a thankful, happy camper.
So have you been able to transform or transmute some of that, dare I say, negative energy and darkness to, dare I say, your infectious positivity that comes through?
Well, I am a contagion of positivity. The guy, the Optimism Institute guy interviewed me a month ago. He's the Optimism Institute. He said, I never met someone as optimistic as you, Dr. Ken. He was like suspicious. He wanted to know, are you taking anything? I know, I'm not shooting up. Listen, if you don't know what to do in life, I'm going to give you one prescription. Be thankful. Start being thankful. Not for what you don't have, but what you do have. If you're not happy with what you do have, you ain't never going to get what you want. Oprah Winfrey. It's true. Everybody's complaining. I see the glass not half empty, not half full. I see it all full. Half air, half water. It's all perception. And so I've been given more than one second chance at life. That's why we called the book, Chris, Second Chances. Because most people of us have. We've had more than one chance. We're stubborn. Human beings are stubborn. You know, that ego would rather kill you than surrender to the soul. It would rather destroy you than to give in to the control of spirit.
I think it's positivity certainly comes across, Ken, and I'm really enjoying talking to you. But I suppose getting a sense of maybe how you did sort of transmute some of that negative energy into a more positive outlook and way of being, and even Dad, through your story, there's I think a sense of having that negative energy and transmuting into a more positive outlook. And I wonder, through the people in the book, whether there's maybe a sense of, say, a commonality of attitude, like whether that attitude is something that you recognize in just about, say, everyone that contributed towards the book. Like, it really seems to me that going through a really tough experience and coming through it, people like yourself and like Dad and like many others in the book are able to get this sense of maybe meaning, which allows them to look at the world in a slightly more positive way. Would you almost generalize things to that degree and say that when people do have these experiences, they're able to come through them and turn them into something more positive, that it almost is a commonality in outlook that just about everyone who's able to do that experiences?
Everyone reached an endpoint where they made a conscious decision not to stay stuck. There was some volition involved. Everyone, one lady wrote, she cured herself of heroin addiction in the book. She says something about when you hit rock bottom, you can't dig any deeper. And she cured herself of heroin addiction, but she made a decision. She didn't go for rehab. She didn't go for counseling. She's remarkable. That's unusual. Most people need other people. But everyone at some level had to make a decision. I believe that the only power we have as human beings is the power to choose. Everything else we're not in control of. You know, when stuff washes up on your shoreline, that's not your fault. No, it's not mea culpa time. But you have either the choice of responding or reacting. Therein lies the decision. So we all made a conscious decision. Your father, there was a point you made your mind up, Chris. I remember in the story, you said, that's it. I'm not staying stuck here anymore. I remember reading your story. So, and me too, you know, there is volition. There is some, we're not victims. We're creator beings. And once people get that, they don't have to stay stuck. They can change the story.
This is following well from the theme of our most recent podcasts, which have been on the ancient Greek philosophers, including the Stoic philosophers. And one of the most famous quotes is from Epictetus, that man is disturbed not by things, but by his view of them. And so this is not something just clear, but doesn't mean it's necessarily easy to have that shift in perspective. But it's certainly different from the idea of looking at our well-being as being determined by adverse events. There can be too much of an idea that it's bad things happening to us that leads to being a certain way. And there are extra challenges that people face if they've experienced repeated traumatic experiences in childhood, no doubt, and other kind of experiences and loss that will have an impact on people. There's no question we're human, will be impacted by that. But by the same token, it's not a matter of just you add up the adverse events or look at their some kind of objective severity and think, okay, that's how we'll be. I think, like you're emphasizing, Ken, a lot of it is about choice. A lot of it is about gratitude as well, and also being prepared to draw on the goodwill and support of others in different kind of ways. There are many different themes that come through, but a lot of it comes back to, yes, not just the events, but our view of them. And then I think, as you say, how we respond rather than just how we react.
Yes, everything you said is 100% true. I will say this: I don't think things happen to us; they happen for us, to awaken us to our soul self. The soul is patient. The ego is running around like crazy. It's got its own agenda. The man-made world of mind. It wants what it wants. But the soul just patient. My mentor once said, "Hey Ken, once you go fishing and the hook gets in, let them run. And when they get tired, you'll just reel them in." So I let people run. I don't try to control them. I say, okay, when you're ready, come back. We'll do the work. Because everybody's going to hit a wall. There's going to be the Waterloo for everybody at some point. And then they'll surrender. Every head will bow and every knee will bend. But it's the soul's attempt to awaken you. And once you awaken, what a joyful, blissful time this is. My sister's a born-again Christian. She thinks I'm never going to see her in heaven. And I say, Essie, I love you, but I'm already in heaven. And she hangs the phone up. This is not heaven. And she gets mad. She thinks she's got to die to go to this fictitious place called heaven. No, heaven and hell are right here. And you've been to both places, Chris.
Yeah. Now, and funnily enough, yes, at 6 o'clock on the 6th of June. But I agree with all that as well. And Ken, I'm interested, and you mentioned soul, and I certainly believe there's a soul dimension in life. And one thing that, to me, the experience of synchronicity or meaningful coincidences can get at that. But I'm interested in your thoughts or observations. You've heard all these stories, no doubt many others, where people have turned things around or things have shifted from dark times to getting a second chance. What role can synchronicity or meaningful coincidence sometimes have with second chances, do you think? Yeah, well, what are your thoughts or observations on that?
Well, I don't think we're walking here alone, my friend. I think we have ancestors, angels, guides, whatever, non-entity, non-physical beings who are guiding us. And they arrange somebody. I call it a divine appointment. Ken's going to meet Chris now for a reason. We're going to have an exchange of energy and information. So the other day I'm on the beach and I see a woman, to digress, she's got two crutches, one leg, and she's scooping up seashells. So I walk over, I said, ma'am, what are you looking for? She says, I'm looking for a sand dollar. I said, they're very rare on this beach. There are some, but far and few between. And then I said, can I ask you a question? I'm a physician. You don't have a leg. Did you have diabetes? Did you have a car accident? I said, no. She said, my parents, when I was age 9, I developed bone cancer. To save my life, they elected to take my leg off. And then she said, and they treated me like a normal person. They never made me feel handicapped or less than. So I do everything. I was impressed. I said, I can't believe you're out here in the ocean, two crutches, and you're doing this. I said, I'm going to interview you for my next book called Second Chances Number 2. And I tell a little bit about it. And then I said goodbye. And I walk 50 yards up the beach, and then I get intuitive hits. And my intuition says, hey, Ken, be nice if you could find this lady a sand dollar for. I walk another 100 feet. I found the sand dollar.
Wow.
I turn around. I run back to her. I give her the sand dollar, and she starts to cry. She says, I've been looking for 2 years, and I had to meet you today to have my wishes fulfilled. I said, well, that's how the universe works. This all because I'm nosy and I want to know what happened to you. Most people would keep walking. They would never even ask the question, but I felt this inner compulsion to do it. So I listen, I get hits. I get intuition all the time. Now, I trust my gut more than I trust my mental. I trust how I feel. And the word gut, if anyone's listening, it's an acronym. It means God uttering truth. Pay attention to your gut. It will never lie to you. Don't listen to this ego up here, which is edging God out. That can talk you in or out of anything. It's not a mental decision. I go by how I feel. And when I meet people, I ask myself, how do I feel talking to this person? Is my energy expanding? Am I being happy? Or if I feel contraction, then I keep walking. You know, you're not gonna love everybody in that sense, but there are certain people we're on frequencies. We find each other. New Yorkers down here, we can spot each other on a beach in Florida in 2 seconds. It's amazing. It's all frequency.
I'm really interested what you mentioned by that intuitive hit. And then you find the sand dollar. Now, that's one thing that strikes me sometimes with synchronicity. Sometimes you get a feeling that something is about to occur or go in this direction compared to that. And I call it a numinous feeling. And sometimes it feels like a knowing that something's going to turn up or something's going to happen in a certain way. And it's mainly been a few periods of my life where I've had that feeling strongly, and a number of things kept on showing up that way. That's what I think is missing at times when people look to dismiss synchronicity as mere coincidence. And they say, oh, but look, the chances are there could be, you know, 10,000 people walking on that beach. You know, anyone could find a sand dollar. But what they're leaving out of the equation is that feeling of the intuitive hit, or what I call a numinous feeling, and how often that connects with then some event coming up straight afterwards. And so that's what, again, makes the probability, situations a lot more improbable when you get the intuitive hit or the numinous feeling, as well as then your, if you like, prophecy or precognition or whatever turns out to be true. So I haven't heard many people have a statistical view of synchronicity and look to dismiss it as mere coincidence, acknowledging that feeling side of things. And yet that's such a fundamental part of the experience of synchronicity. And I think those statisticians are missing the point unless they have some way of allowing for that reality that the people have experienced.
People ask me, Dr. Ken, what's the likelihood of that happening? And I say, zero to none. Zero to none. It's not mathematics, folks. It's beyond mathematics. You can live a trillion, billion years in one. It's given to us. Pay attention. Pay attention. Ask questions to strangers. The universe is speaking to you through them. We always meet people for a reason. There's no randomness. I'm not a random guy at all. When people say it's random, I go, I laugh. You really think so? No. The universe, I think, is constructed synchronistically. I'll give you another example. I'm walking on a beach. We do a lot of beach walking. So I see these six people sitting on the beach. It's a family, mother, father, and some kids, older kids. And I'm walking by and I get the hit. I'm supposed to talk to those people. I don't know why. But I say, okay, on the way back, Judy, I told her, I said, Judy, you see those people? I'm going to speak to them, but I don't know why. All right. So we continue down the beach about a mile. And Judy goes in the water and I hold her bag and I take a picture. That's a happy place. And this man and a woman come up to me, an older man and a younger woman. I thought it was his trophy wife. It was his daughter. And they said, oh, well, let us take a picture for you. I said, you know, we have so many pictures together, but thank you. I appreciate it. And then I said, where are you guys from? They said, well, we're from Pennsylvania. I said, oh, I said, I'm from New Jersey. We're neighbors. One thing leads to another. He's a pilot, the jet pilot. And then we go a little deeper. I said, you know, the last time I was in Pennsylvania was 1,000 years ago. I took my children on our first vacation to the Amish country, and they lived in Lancaster. I said, you're not Amish. You're not dressed like Amish. You know what they said? No, we're Mennonites. I said, but how come you're not dressed funny? Anyway, and I took their picture. They're a whole different sect, right?
Yeah.
So the bottom line is they were walking back with us. I said, well, I'm going to continue back. They said, well, we'll walk back with you. Lo and behold, when I get back, they were two of the six people I saw, the father, the daughter, and I had asked them on the other end, what brought you to Naples, Florida? They said, well, something sad brought us. Our sister, the girl said to me, my sister died. And so we're having a family gathering, a memorial service in memory of her. She had ovarian cancer. And I said, how are you doing? She says, I'm having a tough time. And the father went into the spiritual bypass, you know, she's with God, and he didn't show any emotion. Yeah. Anyway, we walked back and I I then realized those are the people I'm supposed to be speaking to. And I said, oh my God, that's the father, daughter. So I call them over and they introduced me and I told them I was a chiropractor, blah, blah, blah. So I looked at the mother and I had this feeling. And I said to the mama, I said, how are you handling your daughter's demise? She says, I'm having a really tough time, Dr. Ken. And out of the blue, I got the hit feeling. I says, can I give you a hug? She says, I could really use one. So I'm an energy healer. So I get into the hug position with this strange woman I just met 5 seconds ago. The family surrounds me. I don't know how long we embraced, but I literally took the grief right out of this woman. And when I took a picture later on, she was in total joy. So that was why I needed to meet that family that day. But I didn't know it when I first walked by. I just knew it. So yes, it's inner knowing. You can't explain it, Chris. It's an inner knowing. And sometimes you know before you know.
Yes, you pointed to other ways of healing. There's different ways of viewing healing.
I suppose, Ken, well, that leads me to my next question. In terms of you mentioned it slightly before, in terms of your role as a chiropractor, there'd be elements of dealing with medication and that sort of thing. And I suppose almost a sub-theme in some ways of the podcast is this idea of the medical model and almost challenging this idea of the medical model, that being that we need an external fix to things that we can't find within ourselves. From listening to what you have to say, I really get a sense that maybe you would challenge that as well. And I'm interested in your role as someone who is a practicing in the medical field. How do you relate to that? And is that your experience where we almost need to maybe transcend this idea of the medical model a little bit to get the most out of healing?
Well, I take objection to the practice of pharmacology. I'm not against doctors. Doctors are sincere. They want to help people. It's the pharmacology paradigm that's false. It's Peter to Paul. As soon as you introduce exogenous substances to the body, other than food, it'll create some kind of hyper situation. So healing comes from above, down, inside out. The medical model is outside in, below up. You're lacking something. We're not lacking anything, ladies and gentlemen. We're not. This human body, and I mean, they're finding it in neuroscience, we're just scratching the surface. The body is alchemizing the food we eat. It can change lead into gold. And it's amazing that some people are still alive with eating McDonald's, but they are. So you have everything you need. The key in healing is to remove the interferences to the flow of life. When life is impeded, the flow is impeded from above, down, inside out, all kind of manner of illnesses occur. So there's physical obstructions to the flow, chiropractic, that's mechanical. There are nutritional deficiencies to obstruct the flow of life. We're not getting the building blocks to build the temple. And then there are mostly the hardest ones to fix are psycho-spiritual ones, thinking and feeling. They're not in a coherent alignment. There's dis-ease in the system, and that's going to show up eventually as disease. Now, cutting things out does never make anybody more healthy. It may save their life. I'm not against emergency medicine. Listen, during a heart attack, I didn't ask anybody for an adjustment. I was happy those guys came and did what they did. But once the emergency is over, I used to tell my patients, go to the hospital if you need it. But once the emergency is over, run. Run out quick, because you're more likely to get killed by a mistake or giving you the right treatment and you have an idiosyncratic reaction. Oh, you were allergic. We're sorry. That's not malpractice, by the way. They give the drug that's good for the right illness, but this happens to kill you. Anyway, so doctors are sincere. They want to help people. I just take objection to the treatment of chronic illness through pharmacology. Acute illness, medicine excels. We should keep the emergency rooms of every hospital. But trying to treat people with drugs for chronic degenerative diseases, autoimmune diseases, is ridiculous. Doesn't work.
It's interesting how about 75 to 80% of the impact of antidepressant medication on depression can be achieved with placebos. So it shows it's very complex, the mind-body interaction. And certainly one of the things I'm interested in terms of change in therapy is coming back to synchronicity at times, how meaningful coincidences have come up and had a huge impact on someone's trajectory, like several examples of people who in the throes of a suicide attempt, for example, something quite miraculous happened, thwarted their attempt, and then thought they were meant to live. I'm interested, to what extent have you encountered or had an experience of synchronicity having an impact in your chiropractic healing, Ken?
Well, I'll tell you another story. So one day my office is closed and for all ostensible purposes. So it's dark. My accountant calls. He says, you got to get a copy of all the tax forms right away. Send them to me, FedEx overnight. So I go. I have a home office. So I go downstairs to my vestibule and I'm copying everything in there that the accountant requested. And I see a car pull in my driveway. Now, I look through the blinds and I see a guy get out. He's a former patient of mine. He's a cop. And he can't stand up straight. He's bent. He's antalgic. He blew a disc, right? I knew right away what was going on. So the voice said, hey, it's your day off. Pretend he's not there. And then the soul said, hey, what do you mean pretend? Help this guy. So I opened the door. I say, hey, Mike, come on in. I see you're in need of my services. He says, yeah, Ken. And here's the backstory. He says to me, last night, I was on a motor vehicle accident scene. I was for 2 hours trapped in the back of a car trying to extricate two young men with the jaws of life. I was given CPR and resuscitation to one of the boys. They were brothers, and he died in my arms. And when I went to get out of the car, I couldn't stand up straight between the physical and the emotional trauma of having that happen. He said, so I just had an intuition that I'm supposed to come see you. You could help me. I didn't know if you were open, closed, but I took a chance. I said, absolutely. So I put him down on my table. I do energy medicine as well as manipulation. And I just start to rock him just gently. And I start to open his chakras up and he starts to burst out crying. What a release. I mean, he just bawled his eyes. He's a tough guy. He bawled his eyes out. By the time I got through, I got him up. He was straight.
Yeah.
All that trauma had, I lifted it out of his system. We go back into the waiting room. Another car pulls in the driveway. Now the office is closed. Another patient who I had seen many times for many years now, Mike and Doris, this lady Doris never met. She gets out of the car. She's in a state of torticollis. Her ear is on her shoulder. She can't even lift her neck. And I said, Doris, come on in. She said, oh, you're open? I said, yeah, I'm open for you. Just come in. No, I wasn't open. And then so I introduced Doris to Mike and they said, hello. They had never met. Mike leaves. I said, Doris, what's going on? She said, oh, Ken, I just got off the phone with my best friend. Her two boys were in a car accident last night. One of them died. He was the cop who took care of those boys. Now, what's the likelihood of that?
Yes.
Zero. Yeah. They were told, they were intuited to come and see me. And now I never met the mother, but we were all involved in this outworking. Later on, I introduced Mike to Doris and they couldn't believe that they both came the same day and had never met before in my office.
Wow.
But they were guided. They were intuited. Let me put it that way.
Well, I think that's exactly.
I don't know if I answered your question, Chris, but that's another good story. Now,
I think that's an example of living it, Ken. And clearly you do some of your best work in your days off.
Well, I'm being used as a vehicle. I always tell patients, I'm not the healer. You heal yourself. I'm the activation of the healing process, but you do the work. I just open the doorway. I open the channel and then let the body do. But the body was designed to heal itself. We're vitalistic. Listen, the body created itself in two little cells. It knows what to do. And that power, that intelligence does not leave you at birth. It's with you through your entire life.
It certainly helps to have that holistic model, doesn't it? Then I think we've got more energy, more resources on our side, including some resources beyond ourselves. Actually, I'll just mention one other brief coincidence. One of the main people I would have heard of in the chiropractic field, a leader in chiropractic that I've learned about him as much when I've been in America as I have in Australia, but his name is Tom Bowen. Now, his second workplace was in Villamanta Street, Geelong, where we are now in Australia. It's near Melbourne in Australia. And our first practice building 28 Villamander Street. He worked from 30 Villamander Street, the house next door. And so to me, that was an inspiring thing to learn that this character had used all this positive energy in his healing in the house next door.
Well, I would suggest that I'm going to go out on a limb. That coincidence, you might want to go and see him for some health care, preventative health care. Chiropractic is not an after-the-fact treatment. I had cradle-to-grave, womb-to-tomb clients. I taught people that if you come periodically for tune-ups, you're less likely to ever get sick. So my model was a wellness model. I didn't have a fee-for-service base. I had a global fee. They paid a family plan, and the whole family came to me on an as-needed basis, not per visit. Because most chiropractic practices, they were too expensive. I couldn't afford to see myself. You walk out with $200-$300 bill. No. I did a monthly plan, and I wanted people and bring me babies and children before they get ill. Now, the greatest accolade I ever had, Chris, was the mothers would bring their newborn babies from the hospital before they went home to me to get their cervical spine checked. Yeah. Because the birth process is quite traumatic. And many things during the birth process, from forceps to vacuum to difficult labors, will set the stage for an atlas occipital subluxation, we call it, misalignment. The baby won't be able to tell you, but 6 months, 6 years, 60 years later, it's going to have problems. So they would want me to check the baby. Now, the adjustments were very gentle. They weren't cavitations. There was no cracking, because people think chiropractic, hey, doc, crack my back. You know what I used to say? If I crack your back, two people are going to have a problem. You're going to be in a lot of pain, and I'm going to be sued. If you want a specific chiropractic realignment, I can do that, but I'm not a back cracker. As a matter of fact, I would tell people, chiropractic's got nothing to do with your back. It has to do with the integrity of the neurological function between brain and body. It happens to go through the spinal column, but the circuitry is what we're concerned. We're more neurologically based than we are orthopedically based.
Well, Ken, it's been wonderful speaking with you, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to catching up with you, staying with you and Judith for a couple of days in June. I really look forward to meeting Judith, but it's just been wonderful to have you on our podcast today, and I really look forward to that meeting a little bit later on, Ken. You're a wonderful person to have this connection with.
And yeah, and I'll just say as well, Ken, like Dad mentioned slightly earlier, like we've recently had a series on meaning, and meaning is something that I find absolutely fascinating. We spoke about Viktor Frankl last week, and I must admit, I see a little bit of his maybe attitude in yourself as well. And I think it's been a great way to, in some ways, finish off that series, or at least add another episode to it, because I think through your stories and your outlook, it shows that you can't just rationalize your way through all of these things. And it seems to me that in some ways you've developed a reciprocal relationship with the universe in some ways, in terms of a lot of your experience. It's about putting yourself out there and the universe providing in some way. And to me, it's just a wonderful example of someone who seems to have found a real sense of meaning for yourself and is using that, I suppose, to help other people, to connect with as many people as possible. And yeah, I've very much enjoyed listening and talking to you today, Ken.
Well, I'm honored, as I said, and humbled to be in the presence. By the way, anything you see in me, guys, it's in you. This, it's not about me. If you see a mirror, you're seeing a mirror reflection of yourselves. You're two beautiful men as well. And here's my attitude. There are no strangers. When I meet a so-called stranger, I say to them, well, you're my friend. I just haven't met you to this moment. So my perception is there's only one spirit, one great spirit, and it's differentiated in 8 billion human beings, and we're all connected to the one. So how I treat you is, in essence, how I'm treating myself. When I would adjust you on my table, I was adjusting myself. That's my attitude. As I give this, it's actually part of me. And if any of us remain bound, none of us are going to get free. So it behooves us to love one another.
A wonderful parting message, Ken. And certainly the book Second Chances is available on Amazon. We also have the copies at our practice for people who are nearby in Geelong. But again, thank you so much, Ken. It's been wonderful to connect with you today and to hear of your wisdom. Thank you very much.
Well, I feel delighted. And Chris, we're going to have a ball.
We will.
You better come well rested, but by the time you leave, you're going to see a lot of things you would have never seen. I'm a New Yorker. I know all about New York, so, and I know a lot about New Jersey. So just come, relax. And by the way, my beautiful wife of 55 years, she's the real healer. She's the wind beneath my wings. She ran my clinic, right? And then we saw hundreds of people a week. And they would never leave the front desk because she had big ears. She listened. She was the true healer. I was running around doing what I did, but I'd come out and they'd still be at the front desk. So I am delighted, Chris, that Bernie Beitman brought you and me together, and Lisa, and also Eon. There's several other authors from the Coincidence Project in that book. And ladies and gentlemen, go to Chris. He'll sign the copy. He'll take a picture with you. You can't get that on Amazon. So he's got copies. So go and buy them directly from him.
Great, Ken. Look forward to meeting you and Judith. And look, I'll just mention there's some overlap there. My wife, Sue, the practice manager, Sue has a very healing nature. She was an intensive care nurse as well and a nurse trainer. But a lot of what works well in our practice is because of that input that Sue has. So, yeah, that's another delightful parallel. For now, bye then, Ken, and thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ken.
And one last advertisement. If anyone wants to connect with me, my website will that be listed? It's
Absolutely.
DOCTOR, KenHarris.com. And you'll have access to all my newsletters, all my podcasts, and it's free. You don't have to pay to get on my website.
Absolutely. And we'll put that link up, of course, with the podcast today at the podcast page. We can get it psychspiels.com.au. So we'll put all that information and much more up there as well, Ken. But thanks so much again.
Thank
Bye
you.
then.